if your objective is greenhouse gas reductions, high-speed rail is trivial. It does not really make any kind of meaningful contribution. And when the advocates, like the president and the vice president and everybody else, say this is a big reason to do this, it's complete BS. By adding in the construction, it hugely balloons the carbon footprint of high-speed rail, because it's very, very, the construction is enormous, especially in California, where you have to drill tunnels through the mountains and build massive bridges and so forth. So if you see the comparisons that just try to look at running the things, it's a completely phony comparison, and high-speed rail is much worse than its proponents admit. Researchers at UC Berkeley looked at, they ran a whole bunch of scenarios, and we know that planes now, these days, and per the foreseeable future, run almost full, 85, 90% load factors. Municipal transit runs at about 15 or 20% load factor. Amtrak's rail services today operate at less than 50% load factor. So it makes a huge difference in terms of the carbon footprint, if the thing is full or if it's running half empty. Under their scenarios, with the high-speed rail running at 50% load factor, but with airlines running at today's load factor and long-distance car travel running at the typical figures for that, it turns out that it takes 71 years before you actually pay back in savings the greenhouse gas impact of building the high-speed rail. And by 71 years, you're long past the point where you have to replace all the equipment, and so you're starting the clock running again on the operating costs. Reducing oil dependence is being put forward. Well, it turns out that 8 of the 10 projects in the initial batch that the feds are providing partial funding for run on diesel, which is oil, so they're not going to reduce oil dependence at all. 35 of the 44 ones that are in the official plans from the U.S. Government, based on what the states have asked for, are diesel. So for the most part, this is an expansion of Amtrak, which is not going to do anything for oil dependence, assuming that should be an objective of the U.S. government. And if you run the numbers, intercity rail today has 0.1%, a tenth of 1% of the intercity travel. So make a big, generous assumption that after about $100 billion of tax money, you're going to increase that tenfold. You're still talking about 1% of intercity travel. That it's a drop in the bucket and is not really going to do anything on that either. What about catching up with Europe and Japan? Here's where, they present these things as if these were going to be businesses that would be self-supporting. You know, they charge a fare, people ride them. First thing to realize is that Europe and Japan are so different from the United States, and the things that would make high-speed rail, intercity high-speed rail, able to capture a significant market share. You have much higher, the gasoline taxes in Europe and Japan are 6 to 10 times as high as what you and I pay. So driving, just for that, is way more expensive for going between 300 miles between cities. Secondly, in every place in Europe that has significant high-speed rail, except Germany, has toll roads instead of free highways. Their equivalent of interstates in Spain, in France, in Italy, and in Japan are all toll roads with very high tolls. So you add that to the high fuel taxes, and driving is way prohibitively more expensive than it is. It's unbelievably more than it is in the United States. So yeah, sure, you get a subsidized fare to ride the high-speed rail, and a lot of people will do it. I don't have it on the slide, but airline deregulation, we have 30 years of airline deregulation, so it's very cheap to fly in the United States. Europe has only had sort of partial deregulation for about 10 years. And so airfares are higher in Europe than they are here. Japan has never had airline deregulation, so very high airfares. So the alternatives, faced with expensive alternatives, yeah, people are more likely to ride high-speed rail there in those countries. The cities are closer together, so there's a lot more routes where it potentially could be competitive on a travel time basis with driving or flying. Higher population density, far more centralized cities. You look at a map of say Barcelona, compare that to Atlanta. It's about 100 times more area in Atlanta, Metro Atlanta, than in Metro Barcelona. So where people want to go is mostly downtown to downtown in Europe or Japan, because that's where all the businesses are. Businesses aren't all in downtowns in almost any place in America. They're all over the place. So Obama's vision, if you get on a train in the downtown train station and ride to the other downtown, well, that's not where 90% of the people want to go. So it's really, yeah, and all these places have spent fortunes on taxpayers' money having very large-scale rail transit systems in their metro areas. So you get off of that, get onto that, and even if you're not going to downtown, you still get somewhere fairly quickly. That's just not the case in the United States, as it actually is and as it's likely to be over the next 30 years. Now, you would think that with all the inherent advantages that the rail, intercity rails would be capturing greater and greater market share in Europe as they're spending fortunes in the last three decades to add high-speed rail. Well, look at those numbers. The mode share for rail, all rail, but that includes the high-speed rail, has been plummeting in Europe. It's almost decreased in half in the last 25 years, whereas airlines, particularly in the last 4 years, as airline, you know, as lower fares have really kicked in Europe, now more people fly between cities. There are a handful of cases, Paris to Lyon and Madrid to Barcelona and London to Paris, where air now captures a bigger fraction. But those are very specialized cases. They're the exception and not the rule. All right, what about more travel choices? Oh, well, we all want more choices, right? But when you choose to fly between cities or when you drive between cities, you are paying all the costs of the infrastructure that you're using. Your fuel taxes pay for your highways, and your ticket tax and the other things you pay, the overhead on buying books at the airport shop and renting a car, pays 100% of the costs of air travel and driving. On the other hand, intercity rail has huge taxpayer subsidy. Now, I was on an NPR talk show about a year and a half ago on high-speed rail, this Rod Dyrdon from the Mineta Transportation Center, who's on the board of the California High-Speed Rail, did the typical lie that these people do. He said he equated the federal dollars spent on each mode with subsidy. So, of course, you know, all your user taxes, your gas taxes, put in lots, you know, $30 billion a year, say, in the Federal Highway Administration that gets spent then on highways. But that's user taxes. You pay for that as a user. So what's the actual subsidy? Federal DOT's Bureau of Transportation Statistics did this great report looking at the actual amount of subsidy per passenger mile on various modes. And I just put the three up here. And it turns out there's a little squeak of a $6 per 1,000 passenger miles subsidy to air travel. That's the part of FAA that is not covered by user fees, and it's really the safety regulatory part, so I think that's bogus. That's not really an infrastructure subsidy at all. Highways, it's actually a minus $2 per 1,000 passenger miles because the feds take in more in your user taxes than they actually spend on highways, because 25%, as Fred said, is pissed away on transit and bike paths and recreational trails and museums, believe it or not. But Amtrak, $186 per 1,000 passenger miles. So for a 500 mile trip, that's about $90-something of taxpayer subsidies from people who don't ride the trains. You and me, who are paying for that mode. So I'm all in favor of choices, but there we go. So the bottom line of this is that high speed rail is not a business. It's a heavily taxpayer subsidized thing. In the entire world, we've only been able to find two high-speed rail lines that have covered their capital costs, the cost of building the things, out of fares, Tokyo-Osaka and Paris-Lyon. In all the other cases, and in every other Japanese rail line, the capital costs are almost or entirely paid for out of general tax monies, so it's a massive subsidy. In many of the cases, the operating costs are partially covered also. And the Amtrak Inspector General's Office recently did a report that's very hard to find on their website, but it is there, on the extent of massive taxpayer subsidies of intercity rail in Europe. And it turns out, when you hear numbers that are presented, the reporters mouth the press releases that say, well, the operating costs are fully covered by fares. Well, the Amtrak Inspector General looked at what's actually in those revenue numbers. About half the revenue is government grants out of general tax money, but the state rail company counts that as revenue alongside They add that and the passenger fare revenue together. Then they compare that to operating costs and say, oh, see, it's self-supporting from revenues. If you count taxpayer subsidies as revenues, you can make anything happen. So what are the alternatives? There are three primary alternatives, and they all make sense, and they're all essentially unsubsidized. Intercity bus serves six times as many places as Amtrak already. It's out there, it's unsubsidized, it's a great alternative, and it serves primarily lower income people. Half of the passengers have a household income of $25,000 or less. So it's out there. The Union of Concerned Scientists, not normally my favorite organization, you can go on their website, they have this study, A Family Guide to Green Vacations, Low Carbon Footprint Vacations. Intercity bus tops them all. A family of four has a much lower carbon footprint taking the damn bus than it does riding Amtrak. And this is hard for Union of Concerned Scientists to admit, but they did an honest job. It's actually a pretty good piece of research. This is clearly a superior alternative if you don't want to drive or fly. The other thing they do is they compare things like the fuel use and greenhouse carbon footprint of today's cars with future high-speed rail. Well, if you know anything about what's happening, the government just passed new CAFE standards. That means that the new cars are going to be 35 miles per gallon average in about 5 years. And as the fleet turns over of vehicles about every 20 years. So 20 years from now, we're going to have an entirely new auto fleet that's going to have 35 miles per gallon average. And yet, because diesel equipment, rail equipment is long-lived, lasts 30 or 40 years, it's going to be the same equipment in service with today's current carbon footprint and fuel use compared to the future cars. So you've got to make the right comparison. Turns out widening interstates, the long-haul intercity interstates, are relatively inexpensive to widen. For example, the Tampa to Orlando project in Florida, which is one of the two that's actually an electric exclusive right-of-way type of real high-speed rail, for about a quarter of the cost of the high-speed rail, which comes out of for general taxpayers having to pay, user payments, either tolls or fuel taxes, could pay for adding a pair of express lanes to that corridor. So the alternatives are there, they're viable, and they're largely or entirely self-supporting as opposed to massively taxpayer-supported. Short-haul airline service is a good alternative. They say, oh, well, we can't expand airports. Yes, we can, but there's actually more. The existing airports can handle more. You substitute, instead of a 50-seat regional jet, you substitute a 737, and all of a sudden your short-haul air service has three times the capacity. So there's a lot of room for expansion there. I love this example of Porter Airlines out of Toronto, downtown Toronto, on this little island airport that you reach by a 500-foot ferry from downtown Central Business District. You can now fly to a dozen destinations on these 75-seater twin turboprops that are very quiet. The neat advantage of this, you look at this in dynamics and not statics. If Porter Airlines picks a bad route, they say, okay, after a year, hardly anybody's flying, it doesn't make money. All right, you pull your equipment out of that and put it on another route. High-speed rail is a sunk cost. You spend $5 billion on that, and it turns out to be a dud. Well, sorry. Too bad, we screwed up. Politics. I was at the big annual FAA conference when Secretary Ray LaHood spoke after I had been on a panel saying, you airline people really ought to be concerned about massive amounts of general taxpayers' money being put into creating a mode to compete with your taxpaying self-supporting business on short-haul routes of up to 500 miles per hour. LaHood, in his prepared remarks, he came on after that panel, said nothing about high-speed rail. But the very first question from the audience was, well, what about high-speed rail using tax money to compete with? This is what he said. Basically said, shut up and get with the program. That's it. No analysis. The federal government has not put out any analysis, no numbers, nothing that shows that the assertions they make. They just say, get with the program, folks. Shut up and do it. The last thing here, I gave a version of this to the National Conference of State Legislatures Transportation Committee last week in Washington. I was an invited speaker one of only three out of about 15. All the others rail boosters, but Randall O'Toole, me, and the guy from the Congressional Research Service all raised these kinds of questions. Thinking about what former Comptroller General Walker said yesterday, the federal government is on an unsustainable fiscal path. The state governments are on an unsustainable fiscal path due to their pension liability overhang. To think that we should embark on massive commitments of federal monies and state monies that neither of them have is completely irresponsible. I didn't say it quite this dramatically, but I said it, and I submitted the written testimony. So this is really a disaster in the making. And so the conclusions, the benefits that are claimed are very, very small and not at all justifying doing this. High-speed rail is nothing like a self-supporting business. Will require massive massive taxpayer subsidies to build and to operate. So we really have work cut out for us to try to prevent this from happening and getting worse. Thank you very much.
Well, good morning, everybody. The first thing I'm going to talk about is how this sort of broad-based fantasy for America gets turned into a very specific lie, in particular in California, with high-speed rail. And then I'm going to back away and talk about, so where does this high-speed rail nonsense actually fit into the Obama administration's agenda? In other words, what's their sort of program that the high-speed rail flows out of, which is something called their livability agenda, which I'll tell you a little more about. But first, Bob ended with that great line from Secretary LaHood, and in fact, our transportation secretary is a loony. Somebody's eventually going to catch on to the fact that he's almost as good as Joe Biden, and they're going to start watching his every statement and building the websites. You know, and just singling out a few. I mean, my favorite actual quote is the, you know, don't drive your Toyota, take it to the dealer. I guess you're supposed to strap that baby on your back. But he's really his passion is banning conversations in cars. You know, he's focused on banning cell phone use in any technology. So there is no safe way for you to talk on the phone in the car, because in fact talking in the car is unsafe. So I don't know quite when we're going to get the cameras in the visors that are going to keep us from talking in the car, but that's what he's really passionate about. But maybe scariest of all is that nothing that happens that can be remotely connected to transportation is too small or too controllable by us to not bear federal intervention. So the baggage charges that airlines might charge, their pricing schemes, you name it. It's his business to protect us from whatever he doesn't like. And he's very, very assertive about this. Every week he rolls out a new one. And so, you know, in context, it's kind of scary that he thinks everything to do with transportation is his business. The good news is he actually has very little clout. He's kind of a figurehead in the administration, so maybe he's going to talk a lot more than he's going to do. But California, now Bob already made the point, the California High-Speed Rail Authority is enamored of the European high-speed rail. They got to go on a nice junket over there for several weeks, and they just can't stop talking about how cool those high-speed trains are. How many people have ridden a high-speed train? I see a pretty fair number. We got a lot of traveling folks here, right? I've ridden the one in China and the one in Paris in France, and they're great. This is really actually my way to get my... Now the laser doesn't work. There we go. To get my daughters in the picture, in the presentation. All right. The California takes this fantasy of high-speed rail and makes it a very, like I say, a very specific lie, because they say, you know what we're going to do in California, because we all know California's a leader in successful government programs. We're going to build the fastest high-speed train ever. It's going to carry more passengers than any train in the world ever. It's going to be more efficient by far than any train ever. And California knows how to do things efficiently, right? And it's going to have the lowest fares ever. None of those is true, but in fact, their whole plan depends on all four being true. If any one is not true, the whole thing doesn't work. If all four are not true, which is the reality, I don't know what we have, but it's certainly not going to work. So here's the basic concept. Ultimately, they're talking San Diego up, all the way up to San Francisco and Sacramento up at the top here. The basic line is this. Well, they're still fighting over whether it goes this way and down or this way and down first. But essentially, San Francisco down through the Central Valley to LA, and then the bit that connects to Anaheim is the first part of the train. The rest of it gets added on later, assuming we can
out
find
of
the money.
From the first part.
Yeah, out of profits. From don't make me cry. The part of one of my favorite things about this is, you know, these gigantic metropolises of Palmdale and Bakersfield and Fresno and Merced, where they're going to stop this high speed train along the way, where all those farmers are going to jump on to go to the big city. Not quite sure how that's about. But and there's a lot of reasons why this train can't possibly be as fast as they say it can be. So this is a technology, 220, maybe 230 top speed, depending on what the technology can do when they actually slap cars on rail. And there's a number of technical problems with achieving an average speed of 197, which is what they need. But ultimately, a lot of things about these high-speed rail projects come down to that four-letter word Bruce mentioned yesterday morning, math, right? Most of the lies they tell are instantly recognizable by anyone who does a little math as a matter of course in their head. But of course, the vast mass of people don't do math automatically when they hear something, so they don't pick up on the lies. But you know, the killer is this stuff at the bottom here. So you leave Los Angeles, you got 2 hours and 40 minutes to get to San Francisco, and you got a top speed of 220 miles an hour. You got to average 197 in order to make it in 2 hours and 40 minutes. A little bit of very simple math tells you that means they can only spend 16 minutes not at 220 on that journey. Now you tell me how they're going to, first of all, drive out of LA. They can't go 220 until they're out of the city of LA to the north. Then they've got to stop in Palmdale, stop in Bakersfield, stop in Fresno, stop in Merced, and stop in San Jose. So all of those stops, they've got 16 minutes to do all of that and average 197 miles an hour. Let me go out on a limb and say bullshit. So what that means, but for the rest of my presentation, I'm going to take all their estimates as legit for what they assert, and then compare it to, we did a large, very fat study doing sort of our real world analysis of the data to say, well, what do we think will actually happen when they build this thing? So here's one. They say 3 hours and 24 minutes door to door LA to San Francisco. From when you leave your house, an average house in the city of LA, travel time to the train station, get there, travel time to your destination from the San Francisco station. We estimate it's more like 4.5 hours downtown to downtown. But of course, like Bob said, who goes downtown to downtown, even in LA and San Francisco? A certain percentage do, but the vast majority of destinations in both of those cities are not right in the downtown. They're spread up and down the Silicon Valley in San Francisco, and they're spread all over LA and the San Fernando Valley in LA. So if you start looking at we use GIS to look at the distribution of origins and destinations in those cities, and we come up with something more like 5.5 hours to a typical bundle of destinations in LA and San Francisco, well, that's great, except that in both cases, air is considerably shorter. So they're just not meeting what is their crux. They say right up front in their business plan, we have to beat flying in order to make this work. And by no metric do they beat flying. they also assume, and I told you, they assume they're going to have more riders than any system in the world, and this shows you just how much. This is, over here is the pretty good fast train that runs DC to Boston. right? The average is about 80 miles an hour, so it's faster than driving, generally speaking. It's pretty good service. A lot of you have probably used that at some point too. So it gets, you know, which for Amtrak is the highest ridership in the system. In Europe, France, or Europe excluding France, then France and Japan, these are the two most successful lines. Those are the ridership intensity they've got. Well, California's got to exceed the best system in the world by a considerable measure. You know, and so these are, like Bob said, these are cultures where it's very expensive to drive, about three or four times more expensive than it is in the U.S., where there's already a culture of using inner city trains, so if you give them fast trains, of course they use them, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas in the United States, we had inner city train service, and the second you offered us cars, we left those trains in droves, even though at the time in the 40s and 50s, when we were making that transformation, using the car was much more expensive than using inner city trains, and slower. And yet, the convenience and the joy of using the car vastly outweighed the much higher costs that it entailed. there's so many interesting anatomies of a lie in this thing. So this is, they offer to the public, here's the ridership, our high. You know, if everything goes really great, we're going to have this kind of ridership. We have a baseline estimate here, and that's for 2030. They say by 2020 we'll be here. But then when they go out to the private sector investors to try to start reeling them in, because they ultimately, and I'll talk about this, they ultimately want the private sector to invest in this project. They say, well, we have an investment grade estimate, because it has to meet standards that what you sell the public doesn't sell. Well, they're estimating in 2035, they initially said by 2020 we'll have 35 million riders. And then about 2 months ago they said, oh no, it'll take us to 2035 to get to that level. So, you know, the lies just keep getting spun out more and more. Our estimates are that our estimate was a high estimate of 30, a base estimate of about 27, and the Federal Federal Rail Administration estimated about the same as our baseline, and the University of California said, nah, it's not even going to do that good. So everybody besides the High Speed Rail Authority doesn't see anything remotely like their ridiculously inflated estimates. Fares, they say in 2030 it's going to cost $105 one way. I myself think a pack of gum is going to cost $105 in 2030. So I'm not seeing it. And notice how much lower that is than the current fares everywhere else. And these are heavily subsidized at those fares. Ours is going to make a profit at $105 in 2030. Yeah. You make it up on volume. Okay, so the IPCC says we should be spending about $50 a ton to remove CO2 from the atmosphere as our approach to tackling greenhouse gases. In other words, they're the ones who say we have global warming due to man-made emissions, and that there are many, many, many ways to reduce those emissions that cost $50 a ton or less. And even though that was a few years ago, and now a lot of people say, well, we should really be thinking more like $100 a ton, this is the most optimistic estimates of how much it costs per ton to reduce greenhouse gas emissions through high-speed rail, and these are the more realistic estimates. So let's just say that it's one of the most expensive conceivable ways, other than packing CO2 into a rocket and trying to fire it into the sun, that we could come up with. So there's a whole pattern of lies here. The video we watched at the beginning mentioned that the cost estimate for the California project keeps going up. It started at 33. They're currently sticking pretty hard to, it's going to be $46.5 billion. Our estimate is lowball $80 billion to build this thing. The fare started out at 65, then they crept up to 85. Now they're up to 105, and I think we can all agree that 105 is even ridiculously low. But they come up with that number. This is how it works. Is they say, you know what, we have to beat air. So we estimate that in order to make people want to ride the train instead of fly, we need to have our fares be 83% of the airfare. How much is that? That's 105 in 2030 through a lot of weird math they come up with. That's the number we have to have. That's the fare we're going to charge, and yet we can come up with ridership numbers that support that. It's they do it backwards. They don't come up with their fare based on their costs. They come up with their fare based on what they want and then build everything back from there. The newest thing that just came out this week, and I'm reading this on my way to this trip and almost upchucked in my airplane seat, they came out with an official document that says, you know, everybody keeps asking us about, are ultimately the California taxpayer is going to have to put some money into this project? And we keep saying, no, it's all going to be, we're going to make a profit, it's all going to be rosy. But we want the private sector to invest in the capital. Well, they won't do that unless they know they're going to get a return on that investment. Well, how do we structure this to guarantee them a return? Well, what we have to say is we believe we're going to pay you back based on profit. But if we don't, then California will make sure that you get your rate of return. But that sounds like a subsidy, doesn't it? And we've promised there'll be no subsidy. I know, says some smart lawyer, it's a contingent liability, not a subsidy, right? Because it's a liability, a possible payment in the future, and it's contingent, so it must be true. And then that, their funding plan, this little thing here. This is what their latest statement, again, this week says. Okay, they got $8 billion from the federal government. You heard about that in the video. They expect they're going to get $17 to $19 billion. So, you know, somehow we're just going to squeeze more dinero out of the Obama administration. The state already voted, fools, to give $9 billion. Because nobody did math, and they bought the pack of lies. The local governments are going to scrape up $4 to $5 billion. I mean, first of all, over 20 years, most of the local governments, that's their total budgets. And LA is going bankrupt. it's ludicrous. That $4 or $5 billion does not exist. Private sector is going to pony up $10 to $12 billion. Which is a vast percentage of the total private sector investment pool that's out there to invest in infrastructure in the United States over the coming years. So this thing would be just a giant sponge, in theory, sucking up a vast amount of the total private investment for a theoretical concept of making a profit. Now, in reality, there's a whole lot of private companies who would love to have contracts from the High Speed Rail Authority to do work on this. Because that's just a pure contract to make money. Investing, no one's lining up to do this. There's no possibility of making money here. It's all a big tissue. All right. So it's fascinating, at least to me, how they turn this sort of mythological idea of high-speed rail into this very specific pack of lies in California and other places. But let me spend a few more minutes talking about how this fits into the Obama's livability agenda. I mean, for starters, President Obama really hates these people. The selfish bastards have two cars, live on all this land in the suburbs, probably drive, 15, 20,000 miles a year on average, and they're killing the planet, and it has to stop. They gotta quit living like this in order for America to be safe, secure, and green in the future. So he has this livability agenda, which is a partnership of Department of Transportation, Housing and Urban Development, and Environmental Protection Agency. And it has a very nice bullet point agenda, but there's a lot of overlap and duplication in their bullet points. Essentially, the bullet points boil down to quit driving and start riding transit, quit living in houses and start living in condos in the city. And that's really their two bullet points, is we need to get these people out of the suburbs and into the city, and they gotta get rid of their cars. So that makes for a pretty simple agenda. Just, we've gotta get people out of their cars and into transit and into high-speed rail and so on and so forth. The last quote I had, I should have repeated it here. The latest bad quote from Secretary LaHood is, It's time for us to give non-motorized transportation equal time with motorized transportation in America. So the fact that we're spending all these billions on motorized transportation has to come to a grinding halt. We've got to start putting equal money into walking as into all other forms of transportation. Walking and biking has to get equal time with everything else. So, you know, if you like to walk and bike, it's good times. If you like to stay dry and relatively unsweaty on your way to work, you're out of luck. The high-speed rail is symptomatic. High-speed rail is symptomatic of the big, sexy part of getting people out of their cars. The micro part of getting people out of their cars is a massive ramp up in urban transit spending. And what they want to do is use more of the gasoline taxes, beggar the roads more, and build more urban transit systems. And they're moving very fast, quickly to do that. One of the first things they did is, one of the few good things to come out of the Bush administration was they rolled out a policy that said, we have to do cost-benefit analysis on transit projects. And if they're laughable, we're not going to give them money. And they actually refused to give money for the first time since they started giving money to transit to some projects that were so laughable that even people like Biden couldn't stand up and with a straight face say it was a good project. Very early in the Obama administration, they said, well, that hasn't worked out very well, so we're just, that's gone. No more of that pesky cost-benefit analysis for giving money to transit projects. The other part of the agenda is the housing part. And anybody who's ever listened to any talk or read anything about smart growth knows the basic drill, right? It's we've got to densify, we've got to shrink down the housing footprint folks have. People have to live in denser, more congested settings. That will not only reduce everybody's green footprint, but it'll do all these other wonderful things for us. It will connect us better to,
social cohesion.
Yeah, social cohesion, that's a big part of this. HUD's got the lead on that because we all live better lives when we're cheek to jowl than when we have a little bit of yard around us. And take it from Ron Sims, he knows. Working with a fellow named Wendell Cox, he put some analysis together that I thought I just want to throw up regarding this housing. And this just looks at, Brookings did a report where they took a bunch of the metro areas of the United States and they said, what's the essential regime in these metropolitan areas regarding housing policies? And they grouped them into several different groups. There was sort of what they called the Texas group, which is pretty the most laissez-faire by far. You know, we saw videos about a lot in the Reason Saves Cleveland about Houston. They've got a pretty laissez-faire land use system in Texas. And a bunch of cities going up, kind of heading towards the Northeast through the Midwest, have that sort of regime. Once you get into the East Coast and certainly in the West Coast, it gets much more restrictive. And they have several different groups, but the West Coast is the most restrictive, not surprisingly. California, Washington, Oregon, for the most part. So Brookings divided these into groups, and what Wendell Cox did was he said, well, let's just take the most restrictive group and the least restrictive group, and let's look at what has happened to housing prices and domestic migration as those over the last decade under those regimes. So the first thing he does, he compares he compares the housing bubble in the U.S. and Japan, and this is I can't see if my dot's showing it. Oh, it's really tiny. Okay, so this is down here. You've got what happened to housing prices in the responsive land use. Okay, so this is the more laissez-faire, generally speaking, housing policy regimes versus your California regimes. And so this is the U.S. starts in 1996 and goes to 2007. This compares Japan's 1980 to 1991 housing bubble. So you can see that, I mean, Japan's was quite a bit before, but the severity for the whole United States was pretty comparable. But if you break it out, there wasn't much of a housing bubble in places that had less restrictive land use policies, which means it's easier to build to increase the supply of housing. It's where it's very hard to increase the supply of housing that you had this ridiculous bubble out of whack with anything that we've experienced in modern times. Breaking that down a little more, what that says is median multiple since 1950. Median multiple is the ratio of housing prices to average income. Average housing prices to average income, right? So it's a way of looking at how much people spent of their income people spend on housing. And you can see since 1950, 1970, through the United States, it stuck between 2 and 3. And that's historically the normal, is a median multiple between 2 and 3. Above 3, things start to look funny. Well, in 1970, when modern land use policy is starting getting rolled out, you start seeing this differential appear where you've got the light blue line is the most laissez-faire housing markets. The yellow line is prescriptive markets, not California, which do considerably worse. And you can see here, you get the housing spike. And in California, it's just completely out of whack. I mean, you know, look at that. You're getting up to median multiples of 9. People were spending more than half their monthly income on their mortgages. This compares Los Angeles to Atlanta, which is an interesting comparison because, as I'll show you in some later slides, Atlanta is has similar growth rates to Southern California. There's a lot of comparable, Sunbelt, high tech, et cetera. The economies, so a lot of similarities in the economy, not completely similar, but a lot of similarities. But Atlanta has a fairly laissez-faire land use regime compared, not as free as Texas, but a lot freer than Los Angeles. And you get an incredible differentials in the median multiples. Riverside, San Bernardino, compared to Atlanta, another metro part of the metro area of Southern California. We changed the background on this right before this, and we lost some text. Dang it! Well, you can basically see the red is this. This compares again. This is Atlanta and Los Angeles, and it's construction costs versus land use regulatory costs. And you can see there's a slight difference in construction costs. It is a little more expensive to build in California than in Georgia. But the real red differential is the big one. It's mostly the land use costs that drive up. I'm sorry, this is San Diego versus Dallas. It is the land use regime. So in 2000, this is domestic migration for, this is the laissez-faire cities. And you can see that basically, God, we lost a lot when we converted this. Dang. Well, basically, left side is out migration, right side is, each dot represents a city, and right side is immigration. So these are cities that had net loss of population and cities that had increase in population. You see, it kind of, the median multiple didn't play really any significant role in migration patterns in the unregulated cities. In 2006, it gets a little more bumpy, but there's still not much of a difference across the median multiples. Now let's look at places like California, which have very restrictive regulation. You start to see a pretty strong negative, even in 2000, negative relationship where the places getting more immigration are the places with lower median multiples, and it gets really powerful by 2006. And this is before the housing bubble burst. Huge drop. If you put a fitted line in there, it would run pretty sharply down to the right, where people are moving away from the places where land use policies are restricting housing supply and driving median multiples up into the 9s and 10s. It's a very clear picture that while we were brewing up through all of the policies that you've already heard about to the housing bubble, local governments were doing their bit, while Fannie and Freddie were doing their part, ratcheting things down on the financial markets. Local governments were restricting housing supply and driving people out, or ratcheting up their multiples on for people who do own homes to a point where they were so fragile that it all collapsed. And this is what Obama's administration wants for the entire country. The problem is we have these damn Texans dragging this average down. You know, we got to get everybody into median multiples of 9 because that will force them to abandon their suburban houses and buy condos in the city. So, they, you know, I don't want to, you know, and Manny, you probably appreciate this might be part of that conspiracy, that strategy that he talks about. But, you know, obviously they're not recognizing the empirical realities of the consequences of their, well, or maybe they are, but there's empirical consequences to these land use policies that if you take them nationwide are going to make us far more subject to housing bubbles and lack of mobility and things that are going to make our lives worse, not better. Thank you.